Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday at 12 noon to defend and promote public education. And we hope that you'll find this afternoon's programme an interesting one. We're going a little bit off our usual track, as well as looking at what's happening up in New South Wales with the New South Wales Teachers Federation Conference, where there's some very interesting papers given and decisions made. We're going to be talking about what actually goes on inside our classrooms, because this is a technological revolution, some people would say, that we're in. That just might be the hype. And there's a very important book just come out, written by Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna, called The AI Con. And I can really recommend it. It's a very important book indeed for teachers and anybody who's interested in this new technological revolution that we're supposed to be coming into and our children are growing up into. But we're going to be talking about AI and the classroom, and also, we'll be talking about principles, demands for educational research, and just what's going on with educational research. So let's get on with it, shall we? Andy is going to tell us what's happening up in New South Wales. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jane. And here are some reports from the New South Wales Teachers Federation Conference held on July 6 and 7. First up, words from guest speaker Michelle Bruninges. Somewhere along the way, our national identity of a fair go becomes an illusion, Dr. Michelle Bruninges told annual conference delegates. Dr. Bruninges, a former secretary of both the New South Wales and Commonwealth Departments of Education, has been researching schools with high concentrations of disadvantaged students. Our rhetoric does not reflect reality, and the key facts and findings present a challenge for all of us, Dr. Bruninges said. The reality is that our education system does not deliver the same educational opportunities and support for every child. Government schools carry a disproportionate load of schools with a high concentration of socio-educational disadvantage. 50% or more of New South Wales public school students fall in the lowest quartile of the socio-educational advantage scale. In 2023, government schools made up 68% of all schools in Australia, yet they made up 94% of schools with a high concentration of socio-educational disadvantage. New South Wales government schools made up 97% of such schools in the state. Sadly, when we examine performance measures, we see another example of the persistent link between socioeconomic advantage and educational outcomes, Dr. Bruninges said. Now, because the unfairness in our system is so embedded, it will take time to address. But if we're serious about our national self-image, if we really believe that a fairer society is a better society, then we owe it to ourselves to start thinking about it seriously. This is a complex societal challenge that requires creative and brave solutions. There's not one answer, but there's a range of things that we can do that could make a difference. Dr. Bruninges recommended a range of policy settings, including a clear set of mutual obligations for the receipt of taxpayer dollars, a new student success measurement framework, and equitable allocation of capital funds across all sectors. Federation commits to pursuing public schools funding and infrastructure. Delegates at Federation's annual conference have agreed to keep pursuing full funding and greater infrastructure investment for New South Wales public schools. Conference delegates voted unanimously in favour of a motion brought by Federation President Henry Rajendra on Monday for Federation to develop the next phase of the funding campaign expressly focused on achieving 100% of the Schooling Resource Standard, SRS, and a sustained public schools infrastructure program without delay. 1,150 private schools in Australia, 40%, are funded above and beyond their level of need, and a clear majority now receive greater funding from the Commonwealth and state government combined than public schools of similar size and similar location and with comparable student populations, the decision states. On current trajectories, this overfunding will continue until 2029 based on the SRS alone. Mr. Rajendra told Conference the Albanese government's commitment in March to fund public schools to 100% of the SRS was testament to the effectiveness of Federation members campaigning during the federal election campaign. "We can't say this enough. Our members delivered," Mr. Rajendra said. "Our members shared a really good message in our communities, often at the gates of schools where they taught, and parents connected immediately with it. We did it with optimism and in kindness. We were disciplined and effective. We were up against it, but we never gave up." Federation Senior Vice President Natasha Watt told the conference of Federation's ambition to pursue world-class learning, sporting and cultural facilities for public schools, not just for wealthy private schools. "Why don't we have swimming pools in some of our remote and rural schools where students have to travel 2 hours to the nearest pool? Why isn't this needs-based?" Watt asked. "Why can't kids in our public system get orchestra spaces? Why don't we have amazing purpose-built sporting facilities instead of painting white lines on concrete? We should have all these things so we can have the democracy Australia should have." The decision also committed Federation to keep up the pressure on state and federal governments to close the funding gap between public and private schools, which has ballooned in recent years, and singled out the soaring number of demountable classrooms in New South Wales. At the time of the release of the AEU's Ending the Capital Divide in Australia's Schools Report 2024, there were more than 5,000 temporary demountable buildings being used as classrooms in New South Wales public schools, a 30% increase from 2011 to 2021, the decision states. The report identified more than 2,000 of the state's demountable buildings as aged 20 years or older, discrediting the New South Wales government's claim that demountables are merely short-term necessities used to address enrolment growth. 13% of classroom spaces in New South Wales public schools are demountables. It's gotten to the point where many teachers would prefer the demountable because it's got the air conditioning unit attached to it, Mr. Rajendra said. "It baffles us how private schools can get away with being continually favoured by governments. If this isn't arrested in some way, it will only continue to feed the unfairness and disparity between the education systems in New South Wales." Flagship campaign needed to pursue staffing and resourcing improvements. Pursuit of the staffing and resourcing enhancements necessary for rebuilding the New South Wales public school system needs to be a significant flagship campaign, President Henry Rajendra told annual conference delegates on Monday. Federation is calling for 2 additional hours of release time each week for all teachers and release time parity for primary executives with their secondary colleagues. "This is the time. We have additional funding coming in, a la the new funding agreement, and we've got the Gonski funding," Mr. Rajendra said. "Reduced class sizes to accommodate the growing complexities within the classroom, a sliding scale staffing differential that looks at the complexities of our schools, such as those in rural and remote locations, those with a high proportion of Aboriginal students and Torres Strait Islander students, or those with a high proportion of students with limited English language proficiency. We've got to seek a breakthrough on this and we'll continue to build the campaign," Mr. Rajendra said. "If you want to get rid of local schools, local decisions, there's only one way through this, and that's to pull the money back from school bank accounts, allocate it out in terms of an expanded staffing entitlement to deliver you your release time, a reduction in class sizes, and the staffing differential to acknowledge the complexities in our communities." In May 2024, the New South Wales Department of Education announced it would undertake a review of the school staffing entitlement allocations to ascertain if they remain fit for purpose as we continue to wind back elements of the local schools' local decisions policy. This has not yet happened. Until the New South Wales government commits Gonski funding to expanding school staffing entitlements, the local schools' local decisions policy will continue to exist as a worrying feature of the New South Wales public school system. The annual conference decision, Rebuilding the New South Wales Public Education System, the reform necessary, reads: "Such improvements must be regulated from the centre and provided as a system guarantee. The stability afforded by the entitlement to more permanent teachers will also provide schools with staffing differentials to meet the needs of Aboriginal students and Torres Strait Islander students, students with disability, those from low socioeconomic families, students attaining English language proficiency, and schools in remote and regional settings." And finally, in our reportage from the New South Wales Teachers Federation Conference, teachers speak out about occupational violence. New South Wales public teachers have hit out at the New South Wales government's plans to make it harder for essential workers to access mental health support, citing the rising threat of violence on the job as evidence that a safety net for psychological injuries is needed more than ever. Speaking at Federation's annual conference, Federation Deputy President Amber Flom said the government's proposed changes to workers' compensation meant teachers with work-related mental health conditions will be cut off from ongoing treatment, income support and rehabilitation services. When a teacher suffers a broken limb on a school camp or a PE lesson, workers' compensation is straightforward. But under new changes being pushed by the state government, if that same teacher develops anxiety, depression, or PTSD from sustained workplace harassment or violence, the system fails them. This double standard is unconscionable, Ms. Flom said. Under the proposed changes, people who experience bullying or harassment at work would have to navigate lengthy and expensive legal loopholes to access treatment and support, making it almost impossible for workers to access support for psychological injury. Federation's campaigning alongside other New South Wales unions has to date derailed the government's efforts to rush the changes through Parliament. The reality confronting our profession is stark. We are on the front line of social inequality, fractured social cohesion, and a rising incidence of challenging behaviour, all of which has been aggravated first by COVID and now by the cost of living crisis, she said. Teachers and principals also deal with vicarious trauma from supporting students and families through crisis. They burn out from relentless workloads and impossible demands. They suffer psychological injury from bullying. The complex nature of their daily work, supporting vulnerable students, managing challenging behaviours, navigating family crises, and supporting their local communities, particularly through recent extreme weather events, takes a profound psychological toll. Flom called on the New South Wales government to abandon the proposed changes to the whole of person impairment, WPI, thresholds from 15 to 31%, arguing that the health and safety of teaching staff was at stake. When teachers know they have no safety net for psychological injuries, they're more likely to suffer in silence, take leave without proper support, or simply leave the profession altogether. Entire school communities suffer the consequences, Ms. Flom said. New South Wales teachers deserve safety at work and a safety net when they're harmed. The question is whether the New South Wales government will listen and act. Our teachers and our students deserve better, and they certainly do. Back to you, Jean.
Well, many, many thanks, Andy, and I think we'll have a bit of a break now before we come back to talk about artificial intelligence, which is really automated systems in computer language.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
Listening to 3CR Community Radio 855am. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, no, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we're now going to talk about the hype and also the implications of a thing called AI, that's called artificial intelligence, which actually is a sci-fi term, isn't it, if you think about it. What we're really dealing with are computer automated systems, algorithms, if you like, and their use, their ethical use, if you like, and just what we should be teaching our children and how we should be teaching our children. Sorrel's going to introduce us to a very interesting article.
Thanks, Jean. This article is entitled Why AI Skills Should Be Taught Alongside Reading and Writing, and was written by Jonalyn Queto. Education entrepreneur Michael Black is calling for a sweeping overhaul of Australia's curriculum, warning that without early exposure to artificial intelligence, AI, students will be unprepared for the jobs of tomorrow. AI isn't coming, it's already here, Black said. It's taking jobs, transforming industries, and rewriting the rules of success. If we don't prepare our kids now, we are failing them. Black, founder of Success Tutoring, believes many school subjects no longer serve today's learners. He argues the curriculum still reflects a workforce model designed for the 20th century and needs urgent reform. We're still teaching subjects and skills designed for a 20th century workforce, he said. That's not just inefficient, it's negligent. He proposes embedding AI education across all subjects, beginning in primary school. While some institutions restrict AI use, Black believes it should be treated as a foundational skill, much like reading and writing. Kids should learn how to use AI the same way they learn to read and write, because their future depends on it, he said. According to Black, AI is already transforming industries such as media, finance, logistics, and administration. Entry-level roles are disappearing, and students must be equipped with skills that align with emerging job demands. AI is a career accelerator for those who embrace it, he said. We're talking about teenagers graduating into a job market that already demands AI fluency. Beyond technical knowledge, Black advocates for teaching AI through real-world applications. Critical thinking, ethical decision-making, creativity, collaboration, and problem-solving. It's a universal tool and one of the most powerful learning companions we have. Black also acknowledges fears within the education sector, where some teachers are wary of AI replacing their roles. The reality is that AI is going to take jobs away in the teaching sector as well. We know this, he said. Failing to adopt AI learning in schools because you are scared of losing your job, yourself, is short-sighted. He stresses that AI education does not mean increased screen time or replacing teachers, but rather empowering students to use tools responsibly and effectively. Black is urging policymakers to audit the national curriculum and replace the outdated content with AI education introduced as a standalone literacy. If we don't teach AI, we're not preparing students. We're protecting a system, he said. And that system is already outdated. Black says embracing AI in classrooms is key to unlocking better outcomes and preparing students for a future already taking shape. Over to you.
Thanks, Sorrel. The article continues. Despite its widespread adoption, most Australian university students outside computing and STEM fields receive little formal training in using AI critically or responsibly. In a recent commentary for The Conversation, Rachel Fitzgerald and Caitlin Curtis of the University of Queensland warned that this lack of education poses a risk for the future workforce. Gaps in university teaching. While some universities now permit AI use in certain assessments, often requiring proper attribution, this does not teach students how AI tools function or how to navigate their ethical implications. Using AI is not as simple as typing questions into a chat function, the authors wrote, highlighting concerns about bias and misinformation. They stressed the need for students to understand AI's limitations, the importance of human judgment, and the nuances of responsible use within their field. Students also need to recognise how their personal biases might influence how they interact with AI systems. They should be trained to ask whether data used by AI respects privacy, whether outputs are accurate, and who is accountable when mistakes occur. The ethical challenge. Though ethical concerns are sometimes addressed in STEM, philosophy and psychology degrees, they remain absent from most mainstream university programs. This, according to Fitzgerald and Curtis, is worrying. For example, AI used in legal, business, or healthcare settings can reinforce unfair biases or create transparency issues. Misuse in these sectors can lead to flawed contracts, biased hiring, or even incorrect medical decisions. As AI becomes increasingly embedded in professional life, the cost of uncritical use also scales up, they wrote, pointing to the risks like biased outcomes and real-world harm. A call for reform. The authors cited overseas initiatives such as programs at the University of Texas at Austin and the University of Edinburgh that teach AI ethics, though these are often targeted at graduate students. They argued for similar efforts in Australia. Implementing meaningful AI ethics education will require curriculum reform, cross-disciplinary teaching, staff development, and government support. Fitzgerald and Curtis suggested universities could serve as ethical AI hubs, reflecting recommendations from the 2024 Australian University Accord report. Today's students are tomorrow's decision makers, they concluded. Universities have a public responsibility to ensure graduates know how to use AI responsibly and understand why their choices matter. Back to you, Jean.
Well, many thanks to Sorrel and Dale for keeping us up to date with AI or automated systems, if you like, and computer language. And now Andy is going to tell us about principals calling for changes to education research.
Thanks, Jean. Principal calls for changes to education research. And this was published in The Educator and written by Jonalyn Cueto. Published on the 21st of July 2025. The president of the Australian Secondary Principals Association, Andy Myson, has called for a stronger partnership between the Australian Education Research Organisation, or AERO, and the education profession, warning of one-size-fits-all solutions being imposed from afar. His comments, published on the Australian Secondary Principals Association, or ASPA, website, followed the announcement of a review of the National Evidence-Based Education Research Body. Myson said AERO needed to broaden its concept of evidence to genuinely include the professional knowledge of teachers and leaders, and that professional expertise was a most crucial form of evidence, yet it seems to be the one most undervalued in the current discourse. Currently, the debate suggests AERO promotes a narrow hierarchical view, privileging quantitative studies like randomised controlled trials, Myson wrote. While valid to an extent, this approach risks reducing the complex art and science of teaching to a set of technical what works recipes. It positions educators not as the adaptive experts they are, but as technicians expected to implement predetermined strategies. This top-down model feels disconnected from the dynamic and diverse contexts of our schools, where a one-size-fits-all solution rarely fits anyone perfectly. Myson said educators want AERO to give school leaders and teachers a more significant role in how the organisation designs research and prioritises its output. A healthier move would be to build a shared understanding of the complex ingredients of great teaching and learning, rather than simply searching for recipes, he said. Challenging the decline narrative in Australian schools. Myson also challenged the dominant narrative of systemic failure surrounding Australian education, often fuelled by selective interpretations of international test results. He pointed to research by Dr. Sally Larson, which suggests that a broader analysis, including NAPLAN, TIMSS and PIRLS data, shows improvement in primary schools and stability in secondary, rather than widespread decline. This questionable narrative, Myson argued, has driven decades of top-down reforms and a narrowing focus on literacy and numeracy, often at the expense of deeper, evidence-informed professional approaches. He linked this to declining morale among teachers and principals, noting that poor well-being contributes to ongoing staff shortages. Aero responds. In a statement posted on LinkedIn, the chief executive of Aero, Dr. Jenny Donovan, wrote, "One of the misunderstandings about evidence-based practice is that it is contrary to teacher autonomy and professionalism." That couldn't be further from the truth, she said. At Aero, our work is built on partnerships with practicing educators in the context of real schools and early childhood education and care settings. Many of our resources and guides have been developed by working with teachers in their own schools, testing, refining, testing again, to support the implementation of effective teaching practice. Donovan said good research did not exist in a vacuum. It observes, works with, and reflects the experiences of many and allows us to access insights that extend our line of sight to the collective wisdom of our profession, she said. In the busy and complex environment that is education, it only makes sense that we would work together to support the best possible outcomes for students, both in their schooling and beyond. A survey being conducted by KPMG as part of the review has closed on July the 23rd. Back to you, Jane.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Andy. Now, our public schools are open to all children and all parents and all teachers. And we have a very wide variety of people in our multicultural society here in Australia, but also in other countries like England. And there are questions around what should be taught, particularly when there is bullying going on. And there's a lot of concern about bullying in both Australia and in England and also, of course, in America and elsewhere with this generation. So let's find out what's happening in England about this. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jane. Incels, misogyny, role models. What England's new relationships and sex education lessons will cover and how young people will benefit. And this was published on July the 18th in The Conversation, and the author is Sophie King-Hill, who is the Associate Professor at the Health Services Management Centre, University of Birmingham. Sex and relationships education for children at primary and secondary state-funded schools in England will see significant changes following the release of new statutory guidance from the government. There are some stark differences between this and the draft guidance issued by the previous Conservative government in May 2024. The new guidance also looks different in many ways to the last statutory guidance released in 2019. It includes many new and valuable topics, such as the law around strangulation, sextortion, upskirting, deepfakes, suicide prevention, and bereavement. Schools are also required to challenge misogynistic ideas, cover misogynistic influences and online content, and explore prejudice and pornography. As a researcher working on sex education and masculinity, I see many positives in how these issues are approached in the government's new guidance. The new topics are a move in the right direction, meeting the needs of the pupils being taught. Another key change is the removal of the proposal to put age restrictions on the teaching of certain topics. This is welcome news. It aligns with evidence and allows teachers to design sex education that takes context into account. It means they can teach their pupils what they need to know in a proactive and responsive way. The guidance also explicitly mentions giving pupils the opportunity to discuss incels. Incel, an abbreviation of involuntary celibate, refers to those who identify as wanting romantic and sexual partners but find it difficult to achieve this. Online incel communities are underpinned by hostility towards women, resentment, misogyny, and the support of extreme violence against women. They may espouse an ideological position that claims societal structures are set up to unfairly disadvantage them. Keeping boys in the conversation. One aspect included in the guidance is that it is important for pupils to understand that most boys and young men are respectful to girls and young women and each other. It also states that teachers should avoid language which stigmatises boys or suggests that boys or men are always perpetrators or that girls or women are always victims. These are really important points that need to underpin the teaching of misogyny and online incel culture. A risk is that such teaching may otherwise portray boys as a group as perpetrators. This can create a culture of blame that may alienate boys and young men. Instead, seeing boys as valuable contributors to these conversations around misogyny can foster educational progress. Another important reference in the guidance is that children and young people should have opportunities to develop positive conceptions of masculinity and femininity and how to identify and learn from positive male role models. This focus on positive examples of masculinity is a welcome way to support boys and young men in developing healthy identities, not only considering gender, but other intersecting aspects of their identity, such as class, ethnicity, culture, and values. Good relationships and sex education needs dialogue and understanding between pupils, teachers, and parents. For adults, this means knowing the landscape first. Familiarisation of why young people may be attracted to problematic online spaces will be useful. These online spaces often offer a skewed sense of belonging and offer simplistic answers to complex emotions and questions. Young people's thoughts and opinions of misogynist online influences may be contradictory rather than simple approval or disapproval. This requires thoughtful unpicking of concepts and ideals and open conversation rather than blame. It's also important to recognise that teaching these topics is not easy and that teachers may need support too. New content. While much of the new guidance is welcome, it's important that teacher training and professional development keeps pace with these changes. Teachers may not feel confident addressing such a broad range of often sensitive topics without support. The guidance also falls short of making relationships and sex education statutory for those aged 16 to 18 in sixth form colleges, 16 to 19 academies, or further education colleges, despite evidence that it is very much needed for this age group. The rights of trans people and the issues affecting them are dealt with in a limited way, which could affect teachers' ability to have supportive conversations with trans and non-binary pupils. There is also limited detail for those working in special education for pupils with complex needs. One of the most important aspects of teaching on sex and relationships is to create a safe space for open discussion. Young people should be encouraged to provide their own input into how relationships and sex education is taught and to give their ideas on what they feel they need to learn about and what they already know. While this approach is often overlooked, meaningful engagement with pupils is highlighted as a key guiding principle in the new guidance. Young people are the experts on the world they inhabit. It is essential they are listened to ensure that lessons are relevant and effective. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that very interesting article. And Australia's got similar problems, and we have to think our way through it in this new age when children are on the computers and often getting really quite distressing messages. But let's have a break and come back with some more international news, shall we?
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
For 3 years, teachers have had their qualifications, their pay, their pensions, and their working conditions attacked relentlessly by this government.
I'm the proud product of a government funded primary school education and of a government funded secondary school education.
Australia is one of the richest and luckiest countries in the world, and there's no reason whatsoever why we can't have the very best public schools in the world.
It's still not good enough that kids with disability miss out.
Our education is not for profit. Our education is not for profit.
You're listening to The Dogs, the defence of government schools on 3CR.
Yes, well, we hope you're still listening to The Dogs program because we're going overseas with Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to start in the UK, where an American mum who's gone over there has been surprised by certain things that she's found about the British school system. And the public school system in America, she says, wouldn't allow some things that are going on in England. But she might get some surprises by the second article we'll be reading to you, which is earth-shattering sort of stuff for the public education system in the US. So we'll start with the English one. This is from The Mirror, which we don't often use, especially at my age. The Mirror, this is an article from the 21st of July by Alice Sjoberg, S-J-O-B-E-R-G. And the article's titled, it was from the 21st of July, I said that, yep. The American mum in the UK can't believe three things about British schools. And the article begins. An American mum who's recently moved to England has shared the three things that has shocked her the most about the British school system and how it differs to the US. The UK is often described as having a good education system, often ranking among the top countries in the world for education across numerous different categories. Every country has its different rules and customs when it comes to school, and the UK is no exception, meaning our education system can be confusing for people who went to school elsewhere. One of these people is Mum Molly, who recently moved over to Birmingham from the US with her family and is now sharing the culture shocks she's noticed since arriving, such as having to navigate the education system for her son. Talking to TikTok, Molly went on to share the biggest surprises that have caught her off guard since she moved across the pond. So I'm navigating the British school system for the very first time, and here's three things that I just find wild as an American, she said at the start of her video. She then went on to share her list. The first thing on her list was that state schools in the UK can be religious. To this, she clarified through her shock, what? A school that is designated for the public, not a private school, can give priority to students based on religion. Now, I understand the history of it, that the idea that the public could have an education, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, she said, but the idea that if you want to go to school in your neighbourhood, but you can't get in because kids from further away will have priority because they belong to the faith of the school, blows my American mind, she said. Public schools in America, you just can't discriminate on the basis of religion. Fascinating. Second for me is uniforms, she said. I know that statistics are like overwhelming, like it's 95% or something of schools in the UK wear school uniforms, and that's so embedded in the culture to wear school uniform. I didn't growing up, you know, the way it's way less normalised in the US, she continued, giving smart shoes as an example of formal nature of going to school in the UK and adding that it's all very new to her. And lastly, this is something I'm really excited about, is the number of children in the UK that can walk to school is just so much higher than in the US. She went on to say that there are multiple reasons why her child and most kids in general in the US were unable to walk to their schools. This included issues with infrastructure and the way neighbourhoods and roads are laid out, making it more difficult, especially for young children, to walk to schools and back home. The idea that you can walk to school is just so exciting to me. I'm really thrilled about it for my kids, she said. Several Brits soon took to the comment section to share their thoughts and experiences about the school system, with one viewer sharing, I was always told that one of the reasons we had to wear uniforms was to stop discrimination against people who are poorer based on their clothes. Another person said, most of the country went to a C of E school, Church of England, and we're still on the road to atheist. They're not religious schools in the standard sense that people might think. Singing some hymns is basically it. Another one said, I work in a Catholic school in Balm. Our demographic is more non-Catholic than Catholic. It's really not what you think, a third person wrote. Anyway, that's the end of the article, but I just thought I'd mention it because an American was surprised that public school systems allowed religion in their schools. And quite rightly, so they should be able to be surprised. It should be an unusual thing, according to us at the Dogs, who don't think that religion has anything to do with public schools. Now, that same American, Molly, might be very surprised at the latest news from the US. This article is a synthesis put together by Jan Ressinger, who I follow quite closely. She's from the Network of Public Education in the US. This article was originally posted July 19th, and Jan has synthesised several other articles in her essay, including Dinah Ravitch, who we also follow. So, without further ado, this is Jan Ressinger. Supreme Court acquiesces to Trump's move to abolish education department. The Supreme Court has decided that Trump may go ahead and gut the Department of Education. Jan Ressinger looks into the details. She says, on Tuesday morning, Diana Ravitch began her blog after the election. I was confidently predicting that Trump would never be able to get rid of the US Department of Education. To eliminate a department required congressional approval, and I was confident that Trump would never get that. He would need 60 votes, not 51, and he would never get them. There might even be Republicans voting to keep the department. But I was wrong, obviously. It didn't occur to me that Trump would fire half the staff of the department then and dismantle it without seeking congressional approval. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that the president could continue to lay off the employees of the Department of Education while leaving aside the legal question of his power to destroy a department created by Congress 45 years ago. If the Supreme Court ever gets around to deciding whether Trump has the legal authority to abolish the Department of Education, it will already be too late. It'll be gone. Many of us have been paying attention to the workings of those in the Trump administration who spent 4 years writing Project 2025 and are now putting that plan into action. But Tuesday morning's news was shocking nonetheless. Thank you, Diane, for precisely putting our surprise and our despair into words. The staff dismissals at the US Department of Education began on March 20 with the President Trump's executive order to dismantle the department. In a short and extremely helpful summary, the New York Times' Abby Van Sickle recounts the entire history. Mr. Trump has signed an executive order on March 20 instructing Ms. McMahon to start shutting down the federal agency. Shortly after, two school districts, the American Federation of Teachers and 21 Democratic state attorneys general, filed a legal challenge in the federal court in Massachusetts. The challengers asked a judge to block the executive order. On May 22nd, Judge Myung Jae Jun of the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts ordered the Trump administration to reinstate the fired employees while the lawsuit was pending. On June 4th, a panel of judges in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit Court upheld Judge Jun's ruling. 2 days later, the Trump administration filed an emergency application with the Supreme Court, asking it to intervene. In response, lawyers for the challengers argued that the agency's leaders had set out to destroy the agency by executive fiat without the support of Congress. The Trump administration replied in court filings that the department had determined that it can carry out its statutorily mandated functions with a pared-down staff. Van Sickle wraps up her summary. The Supreme Court agreed on Monday that the Trump administration can proceed with the dismantling of the Education Department by firing more than 1,000 workers. The move by the justices represents an expansion of presidential power, allowing Mr. Trump to dismantle the inner workings of a government department created by Congress without legislators' input. The firings will hobble much of the department's work. Particularly hard hit was the department's Office for Civil Rights, which had 7 of its 12 offices shuttered. The order is technically temporary, in effect only while courts continue to consider the legality of Mr. Trump's move. The problem, of course, is that no one knows how long it might take for the US Supreme Court fully to consider the legality of Mr. Trump's move. Education Week's Mark Walsh reports that in a 19-page dissent on behalf of Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sotomayor called the action indefensible. In her dissent, she explained, "Undeterred by limits on executive authority, President Trump has made clear that he intends to close the department without Congress's involvement. The department did not explain how terminating half the agency's workforce overnight would improve efficiency, nor how it would be able to continue carrying out its statutory functions. The president lacks unilateral authority to close a cabinet-level agency. Congress created the department and only Congress can abolish it." Walsh reports U.S. Solicitor General John Saur, his response to the injunction filed by challengers trying to block the layoffs, he says, "The injunction rests on the untenable assumption that every terminated employee is necessary to perform the Department of Education's statutory functions. As core staff have been missing and a number of key departmental responsibilities and routines have been disrupted, in the ensuing chaos after the President's February 20th executive order, the New York Times' Dana Goldstein and Michael Bender trace the story of a department whose operation reflects a new set of priorities. Mr. Trump has not hesitated to use the agency's powers. The department has played a crucial role in the administration's investigations into anti-Semitism, accusations and gender issues on college campuses, and is taking the lead on similar inquiries into K-12 schools and state education systems. Many of these efforts are tied up in litigation, and ultimately it may be up to the Supreme Court to decide how much power Mr. Trump has to withholding funding from education institutions. In the meantime, the agency issues regulations on how civil rights laws apply to various groups of students, including disabled students, LGBTQIA+ students, racial minorities, and women and girls. One of the administration's favoured strategies is to argue that when schools allow transgender students to use the bathrooms or play on the sports teams of their choice, it's a violation of girls' rights under Title IX. The administration has also argued that racial equity efforts discriminate against white students. Mr. Trump has shown less interest in other elements of civil rights law. He has fired government lawyers who investigate schools that fail to provide equal access and services to children with disabilities, for example. The Washington Post's Laura Meckler, Jason Juvenal and Danielle Douglas Gabriel quote, "A member of the staff who has served as a federal student aid ombudsman and who has been on leave until her job was terminated last week. Education Department employees vowed to keep pursuing litigation to remain on the job despite the setback Monday. The fight is not over," said Rachel Gittleman. "The work is still not happening and the harm to families and communities has ultimately continued." She and others have been on administrative leave since March, being paid not to work. According to the American Federation of Government Employees, the government has been spending more than $7 million a month to keep the education staff on leave. Less than 45 minutes after the Supreme Court ruling, Gittleman said she got her final termination notice. Of course, Education Secretary Linda McMahon tells the story from the point of view she has learned loyally to articulate. Education Week's Brooke Schultz quotes from McMahon's prepared statement. "It's a shame that the highest court in the land had to step in to allow President Trump to advance the reforms Americans elected him to deliver using the authorities granted to him by the US Constitution." In a broader analysis in yesterday's morning's New York Times, Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak discusses from a legal point of view the problem with Monday's decision, along with a growing number of other recent Supreme Court decisions in cases that are part of what's been called the shadow docket. In clearing the way for President Trump's efforts to transform the American government, the Supreme Court has issued a series of orders that often lacked a fundamental characteristic of most judicial work: an explanation of the court's rationale. On Monday, for instance, in letting Mr. Trump dismantle the Education Department, the majority's unsigned order was a simple four-sentence paragraph that entirely devoted to the procedural mechanics of pausing a lower court's ruling. What the order did not include was any explanation of why the court had ruled as it did. It was an exercise of power, not reason. The question of whether the nation's highest court owes the public an explanation for its actions has grown along with the rise of the emergency docket, which uses truncated procedures to produce terse provisional orders meant to remain in effect only while the courts consider the lawfulness of the challenged actions. In practice, the orders often effectively resolve the case. Critics call the emergency docket the shadow docket. And it is indeed, that's the end of the article, and it is indeed a shadowy government that the US is now suffering under. And with that, I'm going to head you back to the headquarters of the Dogs, and I wish you all the most wonderful weekend. Chin up and cheerio.
Well, many thanks, Jeff, for taking us to England and to America. And in a couple of months, I'm hoping that, Jeff and some other people will be going up to Canberra to hear a lady from Americans United for Separation of Church and State when she comes to visit Australia in Canberra. Yeah. So we'll have a very interesting time then to tell you that what she has to say. But we've come to the end of our program almost. We've come to the best part of our program. We've come to the great state school. And you know how the private schools are forever telling us how wonderful they are with their VCE results? Well, we're going to a state school that really, I think it beats the lot of them. Let's hear from Andy.
Every week on the Dogs program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week. Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Frankston High School. Frankston High School is a highly acclaimed dual campus school situated in Frankston South. We have a proud tradition of academic excellence with a strong parent involvement and close links with the local community. Our major focus is the empowerment of students to achieve excellent academic results with a view to tertiary entrance. Students are provided with outstanding teaching, complemented by a broad range of programs targeted at their individual needs. Diverse extracurricular opportunities improve student engagement by encouraging students to capitalise on their talents and interests. We are excited to be sharing with you the Year 12 Class of 2024 VCE results. They are as follows: The Ducks, David Hannah, with an ATAR of 99.40, Molly Flanders, 99.0, Amelia Sluter, 98.35, Thomas Lanstra, 98.10, Jamie Denvier, 97.95, Jennifer Charlton, 97.85, Anya Renwick, 97.2, Flynn Rigby, 97, Angelique Tsigianakis, 96.65, Lily Wilson, 96.3, Imogen Tobacco, 96.05, Louis Muchela, 95.95, Kato Lino, 95.85, and Samuel Barrett, 95. With a perfect score of 50, Molly Flanders achieved this perfect score in English. Congratulations to Molly and her teacher, Mr. Peter Piddock, supported by our Year 12 English team and all of our English teachers. Jen Charlton achieved a perfect score of 50 in Art Creative Practice. Congratulations to Jen and her teacher, Biralee Ward, supported by our arts team. And Angelique Tsigianakis achieved a perfect score of 50 in philosophy. Congratulations to Angelique and her teachers, Mr. John Christie and Mr. Michael Simmons, supported by our humanities team. 46 students received an ATAR above 90. There were three perfect study scores of 50 as above, and 9.56% of students scored 40 plus. 19% of scores were over 90, which puts them in the top 10% of the state, 38% of scores over 80, and 58% of scores over 70. Thanks to all Year 12 teachers and ES staff for your outstanding efforts with our students this year. Thank you to all teachers and ES staff from Years 7 to Year 11 who have made such a positive difference to these students and contributed to their growth. harmonious diversity. Frankston High School is enriched by a strong international perspective, one which values the harmonious diversity of cultures in the life of the school. Our international program ensures that each student is based with high-quality homestay families and is provided with a great deal of care and attention for each student at school and at home. About our school. A long tradition of academic excellence makes Frankston High School a popular choice for international students. Located near pristine Port Phillip Bay, the school enjoys a tranquil, appealing garden setting. Enrolments are drawn from various countries to form a vibrant, multicultural student body. Friendly homestay families provide a comfortable, safe and happy home away from home. A settled home assists caring professional teachers to support international students in their development and inspire them to succeed. Now, some facts and figures from the ACARA website. Current enrolment, 1,966, and the ICSEA value slightly above average at 1,070, representative of a diverse urban community. The upper 25% of parental incomes makes up 27% of students. The second level of parental income, 32% of students. 27% of students have parents with incomes in the third quartile, below 50%, and the lowest quartile of parental income makes up 13% of students, with 22% having a language background other than English and 1% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $2.58 million and from the Victorian Government, $11.26 million. Other private contributions add $50,000, and that comes to per pupil $17,499, and capital $16.43 million over 3 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Frankston High School. And our time is gone, so it's up to me to thank our wonderful producer Dale and her offsider Andy and Sol and Jeff, of course. But from all of us here at 3CR and the Dogs program, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joey last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe here last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.